This is day six of the 2008 Idyhwyow Bible School. Our first period teacher is Brother Maury Beal. His general subject is Encounters with the Lord. Today's topic is Zacchaeus. Brother Maury.
Thanks, Brother Jeff. Good morning once again, brothers and sisters. So we come now to the last of our chosen encounters for the week, Zacchaeus, the publican of Jericho. Now, this is not only the last encounter that we're going to discuss this week, it may well have been the last encounter of this sort that the Lord had before his crucifixion. There's just a question as to whether Zacchaeus comes last or whether Bartimaeus, the blind man, comes last. And let's just discuss that briefly for a minute or two before we go any further. Back in chapter 20 of Matthew and verse 29, we read about Jesus coming in and through Jericho on his way up to Jerusalem for the crucifixion event. So verse 29 of Matthew, it says, "As they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him, and behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, and the miracle of the healing of these blind men follows." But notice the point of at which we began. As they departed from Jericho, you see that there, they're leaving Jericho, as it seems, when Bartimaeus and his friend met them. Matthew's the only one who mentions two blind men, and the names of neither of them are given, either in Matthew or in Luke. But if you turn to Mark chapter 10, you'll see that Mark actually gives the name of Bartimaeus, and that's how we know it is Bartimaeus. And it's Mark chapter 10 and verse 46. And we find there that they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. And it's tempting to think there were actually two events. One, as he was coming into Jericho, well, you know, as Matthew said, there were two people, and that Mark is talking about another event with one man, except that when you look at it, either the records are being conflated into one. There were two events and they've been brought into one in one of the records, or else there is something else going on here, especially when we look at Luke's account of this in Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18 verse 35, and you'll see here in verse 35 of Luke chapter 18, when I can find it, there it is. "It came to pass as he was come nigh to Jericho." Now, there you go, in Matthew and Mark, he's leaving Jericho, and here in Luke, he's coming near to Jericho. Now, I had a quick look this morning on the internet, and I found somebody commenting on this who had written up the Greek for this phrase and said, this can mean either that he's coming near, or he is near to it, either coming or going, and that might have been their way of dealing with it. I'm not sure what the answer is to this dilemma. I remember reading somewhere quite recently, and I know that I've got a note of the reference, but, you know, I have so cleverly avoided writing all of that into my notes. And I've searched my computer, and it's not in my computer either. So I've got somewhere in the filing cabinet at home the reference to this, that there were, in fact, two Jerichos, effectively. And if you've been to Central America, you will understand this. There is, for example, I remember San Salvador Antigua, which is the ancient city, or Guatemala, Ciudad de Guatemala Antigua. There is the old city, and there is the new city. And the explanation was that basically along the road which leads from the Dead Sea up to Jerusalem, Herod built himself a winter palace, and he built it outside the old city of Jericho, which had been rebuilt way back in the days of Hiel the Bethelite, you remember, who rebuilt it. We'll come back to that later on. And so there was the old city and there was the new city. And around Herod's summer palace, they had built a modern, inverted commas, 2,000 years ago, you understand, they'd built a modern city. And that what was actually happening here is that Jesus was, and the blind man was in the piece of road between these two. So if you looked at it from one point of view, he'd passed through the old city and he was leaving it. And from the other point of view, he was yet to enter the city of Jericho. Now, if that scenario is right, and if you're writing down a note, put a big question mark after it and say, go search for it. You'll probably find the reference. I found it sometime, rather just stumbled over it. And as I say, I noted it, but not in my notes, which was a bit stupid when you think about it, isn't it? Anyway, I hope you find that a little helpful. It's something to bear in mind, at least as a possibility. Well, if that is the case, then both records are correct and there is no real problem about it. And Zacchaeus turns out to be the last of Jesus' encounters of this sort. That is, where he deals with a member of the public, so to speak, and brings some benefit into their lives. And the other thing to notice about Zacchaeus, and I suppose the woman taken in adultery that we considered yesterday, which is perhaps different from some of the others which had involved healings, these two last encounters that we're discussing, yesterday's and today's, didn't involve the working of any particular miracle in the sense of curing some dread disease or anything of that sort. I mean, Zacchaeus had a problem, isn't it? Didn't he? He did have a serious problem. The Lord didn't address that particular problem. And I'm very tempted here to mention short jokes. But in the light of who we have for a president this morning, I daren't do that because he gets the last word and who knows what he's going to say when I sit down. You know. So I'm not going to mention short jokes. I'm not even going to, the words won't even pass my lips. Zacchaeus had a problem. He was too small, really, to foot it with those around about him, and he found it necessary to find some sort of physical aid, you know, climbed a tree, all right? Well, there is a little bit of background there. And the interesting thing to notice about this is, we'll just have a look at the chronological bits here, just to remind you. There it is. It's actually this is the day or the day before he actually enters Jerusalem for the last time. And the last week is rolling. And now here is the Lord with his own preoccupations. I'm going to just point this out a little bit and maybe stress it a bit. He has his own preoccupations. He knows this is the last time. He's on the way to the cross and he deals with Zacchaeus. And we'll see evidence as we go through it that he expected to deal with Zacchaeus. It was part of his agenda. And so there it is, right before the fourth Passover, and Jesus is on his way up there. Now, you'll remember that we pointed out earlier in the week that there was a point just before the Transfiguration where Jesus began to tell the disciples that about this trip to Jerusalem from which he was not going to return in the way that he had come. And that was back in Matthew chapter 16, verse 21. And somewhere along the line, I mentioned that that Luke particularly, he stresses this, that Jesus has this destiny, and the destiny is in his mind. And so let's just have a quick look back through Luke and look how this develops. If you go back to chapter 9 and verse 51, you'll find that this is after the event that we had been looking at in that context. And it's in verse 51 that it came to pass. This is after the healing of the epileptic boy. In verse 51, it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. He turned with resolution. And now he had set his intention, he'd made up his mind, the die was cast, and he was on his way. You'll notice that Luke has used here a phrase which is common in John's Gospel. And in John's Gospel, the phrase crops up right from the start, from the very first miracle, virtually, that Jesus is recorded as doing in John's Gospel, "My time has not yet come." Now, he's always had that in the back of his mind. We're not going through John as well as Luke because there isn't time. We'll just go through Luke, but I just remind you that it's not just Luke that brings up the sense of destiny. And one of the factors which we will spot as we consider Zacchaeus is this notion of the kind of inevitability of destiny, that there is a timetable, a schedule, as we would say, or Jeff's schedule, as we mentioned it yesterday, all right? So here, the process at least in Luke's gospel, begins in Luke chapter 9, verse 51. And it's about 7 months before Jesus' death, soon after the transfiguration. But you find it again hinted at in various places. If you turn the page to, before you turn the page, go to the beginning of chapter 9 and look at verse 1. He called his 12 disciples together, Luke says, gave them power and authority over all demons and to cure diseases, and sent them to preach the kingdom of God and to heal the sick. And you remember this is the time when he sent out the 12 and two by two, and they preached, and they came back rejoicing the demons were subject to them, and so on. Well, now, we've just read 9:51, which is after that, after they returned, and so on. Now we turn to chapter 10, and we find the sense of pace quickening. Because in chapter 10, verse 1, he says, after these things, the Lord appointed 70 more also, another 70, and sent them two and two before his face into every city and place whither he himself would come. And you can see here that raising the stakes, the numbers, from 12 before, when the work was just going ahead at its ordinary pace, now he sends out 70. So clearly he has the sense of the culmination of the work and the need to speed it up. So he sends out 70, and there's 35 more couples go out there rather than the 6 that he had sent before. So there is another hint about the urgency which is coming up by just comparing those two passages and just thinking what it might mean in terms of what Jesus is doing. In Luke chapter 13, there is this phrase, he's journeying on towards Jerusalem, and it's picked up in connection with one of his encounters with the 10 lepers. In verse 22 of Luke 13, we read, he went through the cities and villages teaching. This is following up the work of the 70, and journeying toward Jerusalem. And he talks about the... he teaches the people, are there few that be saved, and so on, you see. And I said there was 10 lepers involved in that, and I think I have slipped a cog. But not to worry, you see this notion of him moving towards Jerusalem. Now the 10 lepers in chapter 17. Yes, I've got that. That's trouble with memory, isn't it? It's a tricky beast. Luke chapter 17 and verse 11. And now you see that his preoccupation is with the lepers, but there is this thing of going on to Jerusalem. Luke chapter 17 and verse 11, let's read it. Came to pass as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee and entered into a city, certain village. There met him 10 men that were lepers, and so on. Now, the thing to notice about this is Jesus never gives up his concern for other people. He may be preoccupied with his destiny. He may be preoccupied with the conflict which is to come and to be resolved. But you see that he never gives up on other people. And his preoccupation with his own problems was never such, and he never allowed it to be such, that it blocked out the needs of other people. And you know, it may well be that there's a great lesson for us there when we are down and out and feel that the last thing we want is the company and the problems, particularly of other people. It may well be that Jesus had a strategy here that it would be helpful to us if only we could do it. Times we're down and out, these are not times to withdraw from the brotherhood and the triviality of all the conversations and so on that are apt to go on and actually nurture the real fellowship which is hidden behind all those trivial conversations that we have. We meet and say hi and we smile and all the rest of it. And when you're down and out, when you're feeling blue, this is the last thing you want, isn't it, often? And to actually sit and listen to another person's tale of woe when you are feeling blue yourself is a bit of a trial. But it's a jolly good trial, an excellent exercise for us. And maybe we could store that back in the back of our minds and say, hey, this might be a good strategy for dealing with this. Just listen to somebody else's problems and maybe you won't feel quite so bad yourself. Of course, there's always a risk you might feel worse. But I think it's a good suggestion, perhaps, implied here by the way in which the Lord went about. Because there was nobody had a problem like the Lord had. And still, he ministers to other people. He had burdens of his own, as it says there, you see. And Luke chapter 18, he healed Bartimaeus at Jericho. We've gone through that. Whether we've gone through it satisfactorily or not, that's for you to decide. He healed Bartimaeus at Jericho. And then Luke chapter 19, 1 to 10, our story about Zacchaeus. And so here he is. He's coming into Jericho. He's actually in the middle of Jericho. And now another little side issue. Let's just think about Jericho for a minute or two. It's near the Dead Sea. It's 250 metres or 820 feet if you don't speak the same language as is spoken in the rest of the world, below sea level. Jerusalem is nearby, 730 metres or 2,400 feet above sea level, depending where you measure it, of course, because Jerusalem is kind of a hilly place. And in Joshua 6, Jericho was used as a figure for the sin that will be wiped out in the kingdom. Now, just for a moment, I'd like to draw a word picture. Go back and join the crowd that has crossed the Jordan into the promised land under the greater than Jesus. I'm sorry, the lesser than Jesus, Joshua, the original Jesus. Put it that way. When they come across the Jordan into the promised land, is the promised land laid out right in front of them? Is it all settled? Can they just go and settle? And the answer is no. They've got some work to do. Now, the interesting thing is that blocking their path at the point where the Lord chose that they should cross the Jordan, blocking their path is this fortified city, Jericho. And it stood as a kind of a gate to the land. And it's it was addressed especially. I mean, no other city was addressed in exactly the way that Jericho was, with the ceremonial business, with the Lord taking a part. First of all, the trumpets of the priests as they marched around the city six times a day or whatever it was. And then, once a day for 6 days, and then 7 days on the seventh. Seven times on the seventh. I'm going too fast for my tongue. And so then the trumpets blew and the walls fell down, you remember, and nothing was to be left of Jericho. And this was a figure for the great conflict which will be resolved when the Lord comes back. Got various names, Battle of Armageddon, whatever you want to call it. When the Lord comes back, there is going to be a sorting out of the nations. And the city of sin, inverted commas, will go down just as Jericho did. So Jericho has a special place in the symbolism and the history of Israel. All right? It stands for this great conflict which the Lord himself, Jesus, will resolve when he returns. When he comes with the voice of the archangel, which means he's at the head, the shout of the warrior as at the head of a great company of angels. And he goes through the land like a dose of salts and sorts out the invaders, you see. And this business of Joshua outside Jericho is a picture of that event which has still to happen when the Lord comes back. Way back then, the Lord had, God had this in mind, and he sets this up in Jericho to show that. So Jericho has a special place, you see. When it fell, Joshua cursed it. He said, it is inappropriate for this ever to be rebuilt because of the symbolism of that place. It might be a good place to live, might be, but don't do it because it's been set aside. Not only the people and the contents, but the place itself was to be declared off limits because of what it represented. And its destruction was to be complete and never to be revisited. And anybody that did so was to himself be cursed, as you know. And Joshua made that point in Joshua 6, verse 26. And in the days of Ahab, and who else would it be, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt the city to his cost, as we read in 1 Kings chapter 16. Now, it was rebuilt, and people did live there. I mentioned before Herod built a summer, a winter palace there. And it's in this place here that Zacchaeus is living. Now, we would probably think, and people sometimes think, there are certain places you ought not to live, you ought not to be. And sometimes people have said, well, you shouldn't live in a certain town because the ecclesia is weak and you'd be committing spiritual suicide if you live here. And people build up a culture and an idea about places. And it would be very easy to do that with Jericho. And you might think that Jesus might have, in the light of that history and of the symbolism of the place, gathered up his skirts and scurried through and not given anybody in that city the time of day. Well, you see, what this shows us is that these sort of superstitions that we build up about places and sometimes people, there's no foundation for them. The Lord paid no attention to it. He dealt with everybody, people of Jericho and people of Jerusalem. All right? Jerusalem is nearby and way up in the sky compared with Jericho, way down there. Jerusalem had a relatively alpine atmosphere because of its altitude. It's a bit like coming up here and comparing the climate of Idlewild with its beautiful blue skies and clear days and that sort of thing with living in that place down there, you know. And it would be easy to do that sort of thing. And I'm very pleased to see that many of the people who are here live in that place down there, and it hasn't affected them at all. And that's really the small point that I'm making indirectly. Well, there it is. It's Jericho. And so Zacchaeus was living there. And if we read the first couple of verses of chapter 19 of Luke, and there's only one record, which makes it easier for us, doesn't it? So Jesus entered and passed through Jericho as well as he might. And he didn't hurry through. He took his time and he dealt with his schedule as he went along. And behold, and there's that word again. Pay attention to it. This is remarkable. Something interesting is going to happen. There was a man named Zacchaeus, which was the chief among the publicans. Now, Jesus had frequently got into trouble for dealing with publicans and sinners. We pointed that out before. And he was rich. Now, there are two reasons there why Zacchaeus would not be welcome in public. One was that he was a tax gatherer, and the other was that he was rich. And people resented this, didn't they? And so let's have a look at this aspect as a little bit of a sideline. We know these things, but let's get it all together. The tax system was, of course, the Roman tax system. And to Zacchaeus had been granted, he'd actually attended an auction, probably, because the usual deal was that they held an auction and people who were interested in becoming tax gatherers came along and they bid for a certain district. And so the chief man would gain the auction, he would win the auction for a particular area, say Jericho, and he would guarantee to provide a certain income to the Romans. And this guarantee was exactly that. I mean, he had to stand behind it and do whatever had to be done to provide what he had promised to do. Now, the problem with that was that the only way that they could get this sometimes was by strong-arming people. They would go around and assess them and take their money or take their goods or take it out of them one way or another. And sometimes there may not be the means to pay. It doesn't matter what you do to them, they just don't have the resources. Zacchaeus still had to meet his requirement, what he had agreed to do. And so he'd have to go around and do, and these people would do what they had to do. It was basically take more than, if you found somebody who had more, you'd take it from him and you'd keep a reserve, because in the end, you had to make up any shortfall. And so tax agents were necessarily wealthy because they had to guarantee their returns. That's the second point. And the collectors were allowed to take a percentage above the assessment, because they had to make sure they fulfilled their agreement. So excesses were common, and there were no proper means of regulating the fractional surtax. And this is a good reason why they were hated, because they were always wealthy. They had to be wealthy, because they ran their own insurance policy. And so the common people had no redress. And the force of Rome was behind the tax agents. And if he was having trouble with somebody, he'd just whistle up a Roman soldier who would come along and prod them with something sharp until they gave what was needed. And some of the Roman authorities actually connived at this because they benefited from it. There was a certain amount of quid pro quo involved in this, and so the tax gatherers would take them out for expensive meals, and hey, it was business, wasn't it? And you know all about that sort of thing, don't you? And so all of this stuff was going on. The ordinary people hated it, and you can understand why. But this was not the only reason. I mean, the Jews hated the tax gatherers because of the oppression. John the Baptist said to the tax gatherers when they came to him, "Don't exact any more than that which is appointed you," which implies, of course, straight away that this is the common practice. That's what they did. It's how they made their living and got to be fabulously wealthy. Well, there is the oppression, but there is a second point, of course. They were hated because of principle. As the Jews were God's people, and thus they were free. Do you remember that comment in John chapter 8? "We be Abraham's seed and were never in bondage to any man." How come you're saying you shall be made free? What freedom is this, they said to Jesus, that you're talking about? We're Abraham's seed, but never in bondage to anybody. Well, get over it. They were in bondage to the Romans. And sometimes people live in dreamland, don't they? But I'm quoting that now just simply to point out there was a matter of principle as far as these people were concerned as well. And the next thing was that their Gentile associations made them socially unacceptable. And you'll remember Peter said to Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, "It's an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation." So they felt defiled. Jews in general felt defiled if they had anything to do with Gentiles, wouldn't go into their house, wouldn't eat with them, wouldn't have anything to do with them. And by this rule, of course, tax gatherers were sinners. They just broke that law. Now, it doesn't say anything about that in the law of Moses, but the Pharisees had built this law up and said you mustn't have anything to do with Gentiles, and anybody that did was a sinner, which is why they complained when Jesus sat down with tax gatherers and sinners. They lumped them all together, all right? And even Jesus used this as a symbol of the rejected. It's not that Jesus rejected the tax gatherers. Matthew was one of his disciples, was a tax gatherer, and he now comes to Zacchaeus. So it's not that he was rejecting tax gatherers. He's saying when you get to the end of the line with a recalcitrant brother in the truth who's kicked over the traces and won't listen to the ecclesia, then he says, "Let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector," you see. And he's now drawing on the Jewish practices. He's not necessarily endorsing those practices. He's using this as an analogy in an application of his own. All right, so the Jews hated the tax gatherers. Okay. Well, in verse 3, we read that Zacchaeus meets the Lord. And it's rather interesting. It says here that he sought to see Jesus, who he was. Zacchaeus was looking for something, and he didn't know where he was going to find it, and he evidently had been trying to listen to anybody that came by, but he heard about Jesus, and he knew he just had to hear him. Now, the Authorized Version is a bit awkward, isn't it? He sought to see Jesus, who he was, and I've looked at various translations. The one that I like best of all was Weymouth. He says, Weymouth says, he was anxious to see what sort of man Jesus was. And Zacchaeus clearly then is a pretty shrewd judge of individuals. He would have to be, I suppose, if he was a tax gatherer and had to size up how much money people were likely to be stashing under the mattress. But he wants to see what sort of man Jesus is. He's met all sorts of people in his life, and he just wants to see what sort of... But he's got a problem, you see, he's too small. And but that, combined with the fact that he was socially reprobate, you can imagine him coming up behind the crowd and sort of try and peer over the top and have a look at it. And you'd never see him, you'd never hear him, you wouldn't get to know him in any kind of way at all. So he uses a little bit of initiative. And he ran before. Now, the chances are pretty good that there was really only one way that Jesus could go on his way to Jerusalem. But it seems to me that Zacchaeus has foresight. He's looking ahead a little bit. And I've been stressing this with the young people, saying that, you know, as life goes on, we're kind of on a road. And you come to forks in the road, sometimes they don't have a signpost on them. And you don't even know that there is a signpost. And you can sometimes take the wrong turn. But it's very helpful to actually lift your eyes and just look ahead. Especially if you're driving, you know, if you come barreling up to a 15-mile-an-hour corner at 60 miles an hour, you're in trouble. You've got to look ahead a little bit. You see, and what Zacchaeus shows is this aspect. You know, one of the things which characterizes brethren in Christ is the fact that they are concerned about the future. We don't worry about the future, but we are concerned about it. And it's been a characteristic of the brotherhood ever since. You know, part of the reason why most people, in our country at least, aren't interested in the gospel is because we're talking about the kingdom. And I said, they're saying effectively, don't talk to us about the kingdom, that's in the future. My problems are now. Well, of course, we try to help with problems here and there, but most people don't have any interest in anything beyond what is immediately under their feet. They've got their heads down here and they're watching their individual steps, you know. But the brother in Christ lifts his head up and he looks ahead. And I remember that comment about Abraham. I know Abraham. Now, why did God share with Abraham what he was going to do? He said, well, I know Abraham. He will command his children after him and they won't depart from the ways of truth, effectively. I might have paraphrased that. But what's going on here? Why would Abraham command his children? Why? Because the children need to know. They need the heads up. They need to be warned. They need to know the way of truth. You see? And so he's concerned about the future because he's teaching his children. And that's why most of us, I think, or a good percentage of us, are here now. It's because we know that it's good for our kids. You know? You're putting up with sitting in a warm hall listening to me drearily droning on, you know, but why are you here? And one of the reasons is because it's good for the kids, all right? And that shows exactly the same spirit of Abraham. And that's the thing that distinguishes us, you see. Well, Zacchaeus had foresight because he could see where Jesus was going and he ran ahead. He didn't try to compete with the crowd. He ran ahead. And he had faith in Jesus' consistency too, because you see, that mightn't have worked if Jesus had taken a different route. But he believed in Jesus to that extent that he could see where he was heading. All right, small point, but I think worth making. The other thing that you notice about Zacchaeus is that he threw his pride to the wind. I mean, he's the top civil servant in the town, perhaps. You know, head of the Inland Revenue Department or whatever you call it over here. And he gathers up his skirts and he runs ahead. And then he climbed a tree. How many times have you ever climbed a tree in public as an adult? When was the last time you were in the middle of town, right down there, and climbed one of the palm trees in Los Angeles? You know? I mean, kids do that sort of thing, don't they? You don't find adults doing it that much, do you? And here's Zacchaeus, he's up in the tree. And that's kind of, it shows his spirit. He's not a proud man. When he wants something, he does what he has to do it, even if his pride goes down the tubes at the same time. The tree was a sycamore fig. These grow to about 50 feet in height, and they were actually deliberately planted in lieu of shop verandas. Now, I don't see too many shop verandas around in the US, or many other places for that matter, but in New Zealand we have a lot of rain, and so on the main streets where there are shops, they build verandas out over the sidewalk, and these form a continuous covering. You don't ever have to run from the rain, except if you park your car, you scurry out of the car, slam the door shut, and you're under a shop veranda. All right? Well, now, these sycamore figs bore the same relation to the people of Jericho as the shop verandas, as we call them in New Zealand, bear to the shoppers. This sycamore fig, they grew about 50 feet high, but they spread out about 60 feet all around, and they had great big leaves, and they had two useful functions. One was they gave fruit to wayfarers. People walking by could pick the fruit and eat it as they went along, and the second thing was they had these broad leaves and gave a lot of shade. It's a special kind of tree, the sycamore fig, and they're sometimes just called sycamores. And you can, if you want to, we're not going to do it this morning, you can look at those passages there. The sycamore fig provided shade from the heat. And there are a couple of passages there. Psalm 121, verse 5. I'm pointing at my computer. That's a dumb thing to do. I should point it up here. And Isaiah 25, verse 4, where the Lord himself provides shade from the heat. And it's a figure of that shelter and the support of the Lord. And so he climbs up into one of these things at a point where he can peer down through the foliage and see the Lord coming below. And in doing that, he had overcome his natural disability. You see that? He worked around his problem. He didn't sit down on the sidewalk and say, I can't see him, I'm too small, and blame his shortness. He did something about it. And there's a lesson there for us. Not only is he foresight, not only is he willing to forego his pride, but he also deals with his problem. Doesn't just moan about it. He never complained about being short. All right? Actually, I said I wouldn't make a short joke, so I won't. Now, you remember this slide here. Of course, what happened was, I've got to that too quick. Let me just leave that there and just come back to the text. He ran before, climbed to the sycamore tree to see him. And verse 5, just look at this. When Jesus came to the place, Jesus is going to Jerusalem, but he's come to a stage in that journey. He's come to the place. It's a particular point, and it's as though Jesus has this place appointed. And if you just watch what happens, when he got to the place, he looked up and saw him. Now, you could imagine that what might happen if I were doing that, if I were walking along, that maybe Zacchaeus wriggled a leaf or something, or he was peeing and there's some movement, and you catch it with peripheral vision. Get my tongue around that word. And because of that, you're sort of startled, as though there's a squirrel in the tree, and you look up. All right? But if that were the case, the record should have said he saw him and looked up. Well, what does the record say? He came to the place and he looked up and saw him. You see, it's the other way around. This is a deliberate action on the part of the Lord Jesus to find this man. And he not only knew where he was because he came to the place, he also knew where to look. Because he was up in the tree. And because of the leaves and the foliage and the situation and the press of people around and the conversation that he may have been in. I mean, when I get in conversation, if we walk up here, I don't see my own wife when she's walking the other way or walking alongside, or she started out differently. You know what I'm saying? You get preoccupied with the immediate thing. Well, not Jesus. He's aware of everything all around him. He gets to the place and he looks up. And then he sees him. See, it wasn't the other way around. That's my point. And I think it's worth noting that. And he said to him, and here's the sense of destiny and timetable once again. Zacchaeus, he says, make haste and come down. Zacchaeus had already made haste. Well, carry on making haste. That's the story. And come down. For today I must abide at your house. So there you are. It was on his schedule. This is the Lord looking at his itinerary and saying, well, it's Friday and it's just about lunchtime. I'm supposed to be at Zacchaeus' house. You see that? And that sense of destiny is there, which is kind of interesting. So he went into Zacchaeus' house, and it says that Zacchaeus received him joyfully. Well, now, I just want you to think about that too. When Zacchaeus got up in the morning, had he any idea that he was going to be host to the Messiah, to the Christ, the Holy One of God? Was he prepared for this? Had he engineered all of this so that he would take him home for lunch? I don't think so. And I think that if it had been me, I would have had some reservations. I mean, who, me? Have Jesus come to dine? And Zacchaeus does it without any preparation, without any warning. And he does it joyfully, and it just shows the spirit that we need to bring to bringing Jesus into our lives, to do so joyfully, right? There it is. And just a little side issue, and I'll get my ear bent for this later on, I'm sure. Did he ask, yes, I see a head down here on my right nodding. Did he ask Mrs. Zacchaeus about this? Huh? What was she going to say about this? She hadn't had time to, whatever it is that ladies do, you know, before this event. Look, there are some issues which are just too big for all of that stuff. And when we have the opportunity to bring the Lord into our house, whether it's the Lord or one of those least of his, then that's the important issue, isn't it? And you learn that from Zacchaeus too. And that man hadn't the advantage of sitting through the Idlewild Bible School to get it sorted in his head about priorities. You see what I'm saying? He just does it. This is the nature of the man, right? And so he sits down at table. Now, they had this odd custom that you see hints of here and there in the scriptures. When there is a feast going on in the house, other people can come in. Socially acceptable. I mean, it wouldn't wash in New Zealand. I bet it wouldn't wash in North America either. But, you know, you've got honoured guests in, public people. They come in and you're around the table in the way that we described the other day. And other people come along. They don't necessarily eat there, but they stand around the back, around the outside. And there's evidence that they could discuss what was going on. They were allowed to listen to the conversation. They even talked amongst themselves about what was being said. They weren't allowed to actually participate in the actual conversation. It's a weird kind of culture to us, but it seemed to have been the culture that was there. And my having pointed that out may sharpen you up a little bit just to look at that sometimes when you're doing your readings. You'll find hints of this here and there. All right? And so the other people came in too. And you see here in this is going on, verse 7, when the feast is going on, when they saw it. And it's interesting, Luke doesn't say who they are. Who saw it? And I've got a list here. They all murmured. They murmured that Jesus was guest to a sinner, Luke chapter 19, verse 7. You see, so they've written Zacchaeus off before he's even started with them, effectively. They all murmured, saying that he was gone to be guest with a man that is a sinner. They've made up their mind. Now, that he was a publican, there was no doubt about that. But that he was necessarily a sinner, that doesn't follow. It's not a necessary inference. Who were they? And I've got a list of quotations there. Basically, they were the scribes and the Pharisees. And they've gone along, they're trailing Jesus. And they're not sympathetic, they're just looking for occasion to find fault. So they trail into Zacchaeus' house, a place they would never normally be seen dead. They wouldn't go into a Gentile's house to save themselves. But they'll go into a Gentile's house to destroy themselves, because the witness of what happened here reflected against them too. We'd better be ready for criticism, brothers and sisters. It doesn't matter what we do, somebody is going to find fault. And I think the best thing for us to do is to be prepared to accept that and just accept it as inevitable. Somebody will find fault. Certainly Zacchaeus was a publican, but in itself that didn't make him a sinner. We ought not to prejudge people. That's what it's saying. All men are sinners, especially those who murmur. And there's a lesson there for us, isn't there? Well, slide 10. How does Zacchaeus respond to that? Zacchaeus stood up. He was presumably at the table. It may well be that he'd placed himself in the lowest position, in the lowest room, and that Jesus was the honoured guest in the highest position. It may be. We don't know. It doesn't say. But now, when he hears the murmuring from around the walls in the room, he stands up and he addresses the Lord. Now, it's interesting that he doesn't argue the toss with the murmurers. He leaves them entirely alone, because sometimes there's nowhere to go with people like that. And he takes his problem to the Lord. So he stood up and he addressed the Lord. And it's in verse 8. And the first thing you notice about this is that he is able to stand in the Lord's presence. And so he's now alongside the woman taken in adultery that we looked at yesterday, for example. He addressed the Lord, not the murmurers. And notice this, when he said in verse 8, Zacchaeus stood, said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord," and there's that word again. I want you to notice this particularly, saying to Jesus, "The half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I've taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." And the natural way for people to read that, and the way that most people do read that, is from this moment forth, I'm going to give half of my goods to the poor, and if I take anything by false accusation, I will restore it fourfold. But that's not what he said. What he said was, "The half of my goods I do give to the poor. And if I take something by false accusation, I do restore it fourfold." This was his settled policy. He was already doing this. So you see, you shouldn't prejudge. You don't know what people are doing in their private lives. And you mustn't jump to conclusions. You certainly mustn't listen to what other people said, because the whole population felt this about Zacchaeus, because that was the line that they'd been fed. They didn't know that. They didn't know Zacchaeus. How could they say? You see? And so what a remarkable thing this is. Moses' law said that you should help the poor, right? So he did what the law said, Deuteronomy 15. Moses commanded that illicit gain be restored in principle together with a 20% supercharge by way of compensation. That's Leviticus chapter 6. But he went a long way further than that. He looked at his profits and he said, at the end of the year, I don't have to store this. I'll take half of my profit and I'll give it back to the poor. And if I discover that I have done something unjust, I'll do it fourfold, which is what the law said about stealing something. You give it back fourfold. Or if it's an ox, you give it back fivefold if it's an ox. So this man had the spirit of the law of Moses. You know, you shouldn't prejudge people like this. And the fact that there is one, even if there's only one Zacchaeus, we should be careful not to prejudge, shouldn't we? All right. And finally, Jesus responds. Jesus said to him, and he said it publicly so that we can listen in too. It's a privilege to hear it. Jesus said to him, "This day is salvation come to this house, for as much as he also is a son of Abraham." And Jesus knew that before this encounter ever began. And he just wants Zacchaeus to know it too. And he's giving encouragement to Zacchaeus to give him strength to carry on. Should say something about the seed of Abraham. Salvation was come to the house not because of the works that he'd done, but because of the faith that gave rise to it. Zacchaeus' Hebrew name means pure. That's what it means. He was a son of Abraham, and you really want to, perhaps I've got to stop, put John chapter 8 verse 39 there. Fundamentally, to be a son of Abraham means that you make the way of your life subservient to the way of God. If your life is subservient to God's ways, you are a son of Abraham, and you come under the definition. Jesus had come to seek and to save the lost, and here you find he's dealing with a person who's down in a pit, and he's pulling him out. It's not the Sabbath day, but he's pulling him out, because the Son of Man has not come to, he has come to seek and to save those who are lost. They that are whole don't need a physician, but those that are sick. And the Lord God has come and ministered to him. I must sit down. It's been a wonderful week. I have thoroughly enjoyed our time in Southern California and the Idlewild Bible School. Coral and I are going to take our love for you all back with us to New Zealand, do our best to share it. It's been a fantastic time. Thank you, Brother Jeff. I won't presume on your timetable any further. No short cuts.